You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jeff Stein, Washington Post White House economics reporter, and Elizabeth Pancotti, policy advisor for Employee America on the COVID relief bill. What's in? What's out? And what more is desperately needed? Meanwhile, UK COVID variant is up to 70% more contagious, earning them a worldwide travel restriction. Meanwhile, California hospitals contemplate COVID care rationing. Anthony Fauci predicts the majority of the country will be vaccinated by August. And Trump's bunker becoming even deeper as he lashes out at his pals. Feds are contemplating a subpoena for Giuliani's emails. And Trump weighing in on lawsuit immunity for the Saudi prince and his involvement in Khashoggi's killing. Cook County health care workers hold a one-day strike, and U.S. Postal Service Christmas delivery is crushed by COVID and the Trump administration changes. And lastly, Robert E. Lee statue is removed from the Capitol.
Much to the chagrin of PragerU.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we will get to that. That is quite a video they put out. Emma Viglin is here, with me, folks. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to our little vacation and Christmas too, as a Protestant. Not really anymore, but,
you don't have to justify. People look forward to Christmas for all sorts of reasons.
Right. I'm a pagan, but I enjoy the festivities.
Well, there it is. And yesterday, of course, was the longest day of the year. So things are starting to lighten up around here. I've already noticed the difference. We've got sundown is, I think, at a minute later than it was yesterday. And so enjoy that extra time, folks. We will be doing our final live show tomorrow. So make sure you stay with us. The stimulus bill, COVID relief, passed last night. House and Senate, every reason to believe Donald Trump will sign it. I don't know if he's actually physically signed it yet. But here is Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate. Very, very upset. Now, look, we have a tremendous amount of data that show the efficacy of giving people money who are in poverty. We have a tremendous amount of data from just the CARES Act back in March, the implications of giving people money when not just when they've lost their job, but when they are everybody was shut down for a month. You've got rents building up, helps take people out of poverty. We had, I think, one of our lowest periods of poverty in the months following the increase in unemployment insurance, federal augmentation, I guess, of that insurance, and also these direct payments. So we know it works.
And Republicans saw that as a problem because maybe they're getting $20 more a week than they normally would at their job that pays them a starvation wage.
Right. I mean, the idea that they're getting pulled out of poverty, that's could be a problem. That could actually give people who are working a little bit more bargaining power when it comes to dealing with their employers. Here is Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate, talking in very religious terms about helping people out during this time.
Senator from Kentucky.
Republicans like to mock modern monetary theory, the idea that government can print money with impunity, that government can spend whatever it wants without the need to tax. Modern monetary theory is basically the Dick Cheney deficits don't matter crowd, trussed up with a new fancy title. Most Republicans rightly lampoon this quackery, that is, when they're not practicing the quackery themselves. Today, many of these same Republicans will vote for a bill that makes modern monetary theory look like child's play in comparison. The monster spending bill presented today is not just a deficits don't matter disaster, it is everything Republicans say they don't believe in. This bill is free money for everyone. Proponents don't care if you're fully employed or own your own house or own your own business. Free money for everyone, they cry. And yet, if free money were the answer, if money really grew on trees, why not give more free money? Why not give it out all the time? Why stop at $600 a person? Why not $1,000? Why not $2,000? Maybe these new free money Republicans should join the Everybody Gets a Guaranteed Income Caucus. Why not $20,000 a year for everybody? Why not $30,000? If we can print up money with impunity, why not do it? The Treasury can just keep printing the money. That is, until someone points out that the emperor has no clothes and that the dollar no longer has value. To so-called conservatives who are quick to identify the socialism of Democrats, if you vote for this spending monstrosity, you are no better. When you vote to pass out free money, you lose your soul and you abandon forever any semblance of moral or fiscal integrity. So the next time you see
Wow.
You lose your soul. I mean, I guess Jesus, who said that it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle. I guess he was a soulless monster himself.
I mean, I don't know about that. I'm not. I haven't spent that much time studying my late antiquity. But the idea that you lose your soul and your integrity if you provide. First off, let's just talk because there's so much here that is. Sort of stunning for him to say. This is a guy, you'll recall the tax cuts that were passed under the Trump administration. The Republicans in both houses passed tax cuts in 2017, creating a massive deficit, massive, nearly a, you know, it was $700 billion, I think it was. And these are tax cuts that, particularly now that we're a couple years out, are primarily geared towards the very, very wealthy in this country. Apparently, deficits don't matter to him, who is religious about this and moral about this when it's a question of giving free money, because that's what you're doing. There's a certain amount of dues it takes from everyone in society to function this club we have called society or America. And when you are forgiven those dues, you are basically offloading those expenses to someone else. And that's what those tax cuts are. They are free services in kind for wealthy people.
But you don't understand, Sam, there's a cognitive dissonance that Republicans can fall back on, that it's not exactly giving money to people when they're desperate. They can say, oh, we're just diverting those funds or we're just cutting taxes, right? Even though it's essentially exactly what you're saying, giving money back to wealthy people. It's just not the direct cash payments right into their bank account.
It's as far as the U.S. government is concerned, it's the exact same thing. It's just a number on a ledger. And the reality is that money does not grow on trees. It actually can be produced much, much quicker. It was done during the financial crisis. It was done now. We can actually give people, and I think there's, you know, he raises a good question. Why not give more money to people, even in times where there's not a crisis? We could give people more money. We could give people more basic services. We could decommodify things like healthcare. We can, in fact, do this. And he doesn't really talk about the consequences. All he talks about is quackery. And when you talk about quackery, you can look back at all the talk about quantitative easing 1 and QE 2 and QE 3 back in 2009, 2010. And all we heard was that we're going to turn into this hyperinflation like Weimar Republic. And the fact of the matter is that the dollar is not pegged to gold anymore, that there's no reason to believe that the dollar I print tomorrow has any less value than the dollar I print today, that if I print $2 tomorrow, it has any less value than the $1 or $2 I print today. And there's an easy ability by the Fed and by our federal government to control inflation if the economy overheats. But that's not our problem right now.
Certainly not our problem.
You can right do now. That by taxation. You can do that by tightening the money supply. There's many arrows in that quiver. But Rand Paul talking about financial quackery or any type of quackery is in and of itself a hoot.
Well, he'd rather fall back on his religious ideology of libertarianism, where you can feel like a moral person without actually governing morally, just because you have a strict ideology, as opposed to just taking situations as they are and realizing my job as a senator is to make lives better for Americans, not just act like a college sophomore who's been learning and reading about specific books and applying them directly to my governing philosophy.
We will we'll talk to Jeff Stein and Elizabeth Pancotti in just a moment about what has been included in this package and what's been left out. In the meantime, this program is brought to you today by Sunset Lake CBD. Check out sunsetlakecbd.com. This is a great company. They're fans of the show. They have been promoting their stuff on this program basically throughout 2020. Great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They practice regenerative farming practices with the help of the University of Vermont. They're located up near Burlington. Their farm started out as a dairy farm, providing milk for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They still do. They decided to diversify. 100% pesticide-free, organic fertilizer, and their products are awesome. Matt is a big fan of the smalls. I'm a big fan of the tincture. Helps me get to sleep, and the salve, as it were, that it's good for your muscles. I find it good for some my dry skin, frankly.
I'm sure your dry skin is needing some of the salve right
now. Oh, my gosh. Yes, constantly. Yeah. And gummy bears, they have CBD-infused coffee. Check it out, folks. And right now, if you head over there, there's a sale going on. Usually, it's the left is best promo code, but right now, you can get 25% off with promo code GIFT25. You get a free 125 milligram salve if you order $75 or more. You get a free 750 milligram tincture if you order $100 or more. And you can get both items free if you order $125 or more. Check it out, sunsetlakecbd.com. Also, don't forget, this program is supported by our members. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget to check out Nomi's show, youtube.com, The Noma Key Show. And all right, with us now, hopefully, we have Jeff Stein. He is the Washington Post White House economics reporter. And there he is. He's
hey, Sam, what's going on?
Jeff, how you doing?
Hey, Sam.
I'm good. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you pretty well. Emma's here with us. We can see you. We can see your hand. It's huge. Appreciate you joining us. All right. So let's go through, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth Pancotti about, some of the unemployment, features and the pandemic, unemployment assistance. But give us a sense of, broadly speaking, what is in this $900 billion, package. But let me just start with this question. Originally, we heard $900 billion. And about $180 billion was sequestered in a second package that was ostensibly going to be two bills, right? At one point, it had been broken off into two bills where the corporate liability and the city and state funding were going to be put aside. How did that difference between that money come into this $900 billion bill? Because all of a sudden it went from like 720 to $900 billion. Where does this money broadly break down?
Okay, so really good question. I know it's probably insane to try to follow this. Like, it's my full-time job and all I've been thinking about for months, and I still get confused. So I understand for most people, it's just probably intractable. The big picture, what's in the bill, I think the most easy way to think about it is sort of like three big buckets. And the first big bucket is like $330 billion for small business aid. The second big bucket, smaller, but the second substantial one, is unemployment insurance, about $150 billion for that, and a similar amount for the second round of stimulus payments. And then you have like a dozen substantially smaller buckets that break down rental assistance, hunger assistance, money for schools, money for vaccine distributions. Those are like ballparking here, but like $50 billion or so. And those go down the list like that. Your question is sort of about like the sequencing of how, you know, at the beginning of this month, Joe Manchin and Mitt Romney came out with a $900 billion proposal. It included $200 billion in state aid. Then that appeared to fall out of the package. So it looked like, why couldn't they just, you know, put a, you know, large number of that, you know, put stimulus checks instead of the state aid, and then, you know, the package would be all ready to go. But in the final version, unemployment benefits and stimulus checks were much smaller than they could have been if you had just said, take out the state aid, keep unemployment the same, and put stimulus checks on top. And so what you're picking up on very perceptively, I think, is that the size of the small business portion, the pot that went to business aid, and some people will say not just small businesses, but, you know, sometimes large businesses, that pot continued to grow. And so when you accepted the Republican framework of $900 billion being the maximum amount that could be spent, it meant that every dollar that was increased for small business aid meant that the amount of money available for other priorities would shrink. And so as a result, we saw some pretty important limits on both the stimulus checks. Not only are they only $600 per person instead of $1,200, they also exclude adult dependents. You know, this is a huge population of 13.5 million people, according to Matt Bruning of the People's Policy Project, will be shut out of stimulus payments because of that. That's a lot of students and disabled people who are going to be deprived of checks. And there are huge limits on the unemployment provisions as well. A lot of people are expecting the vaccine distribution to not really begin in earnest until the summer. The unemployment provisions in this bill expire in 11 weeks. That's mid-March. So a lot of people are going to be thrown off of unemployment benefits really way before the labor market is safe to return to at normal levels. But hopefully that answers some of your questions a little bit.
No, you know, that does. I mean, basically what happened is that $180 billion went more into the PPP than in other areas, is what I'm hearing you say. And let me ask you this, if that's the case. My understanding, there were two tranches of the PPP. This is the Paycheck Protection Program. This is just to remind people, it was a loan from the U.S. government to small businesses. And I put that in quotes because there's been some significant controversy about some of the people who have gotten it. And you had, I think it was 8 to 10 weeks of payroll that you could pay, and maybe I think also including rent. And if you showed the government that you spent that money on payroll over those 8 to 10 weeks, you would basically be granted that money after the fact. But wasn't there in the second tranche of PPP, by the time they were done, wasn't there like $130 billion left over? Like, they didn't even exhaust that. And it seems to me, if you're a business that could get through, I don't know, whatever, 10 weeks out from March or April, if you could get through July of 2020, that you're in business and you're in business. Like, it's, you've made it work. Where was the need? What was the theory behind the need for this? Other than just like, we're giving out money, let's give it to small business owners who don't necessarily need it. And that encourages people to go back to work in a situation where, you know, we need like a couple of months to get past this.
Yeah, so really good questions. I think one thing to keep in mind in terms of your identifying correctly the fact that there were about, you know, $150 billion in money for PPP that was just sort of sitting around. And for months, people were like, why don't they do something with this extra cash? People are suffering desperately, and it's just sitting in some treasury accounts somewhere, not getting spent. And the reason they couldn't just get that money out, and the reason they're still approving new PPP money, even though it seems like the funds were exhausted, and they were exhausted, is because businesses only qualified for one round of PPP funding. But then once that was up, they weren't able to reapply for the extra remaining funds. So what Congress is doing now is saying, okay, you're a restaurant, you've been hit really hard, you got your first round of PPP money, we have all this extra money left over. Initially, you couldn't apply for that because it was just the first tranche. But now that you're into the winter, it's months later, now that Congress is passing a bill, you'll be able to apply for a second round of PPP funding. And then to your question of why are we doing this, I think there's the defense that people on the Hill would give you who are involved in this will say, when we first rushed it out, we were trying to minimize documentation as much as possible because there was just such a need to just say, let's just get the money out as much as possible. We understand that there's going to be waste here, and that's the price we're willing to pay. But this time around, they're including pretty strict revenue decline verification that businesses are going to have to show, unlike last time, that they've taken a large economic hit, that the revenue, I think, is down. Initially, it was supposed to be 33%, and then enough business lobbyists were complaining that they lowered it to 25%. You have to demonstrate a 25% revenue decline to qualify for PPP funding this time. And I think the other argument that defenders of this decision would make is that, the unemployment systems are a complete mess. And for 30 years, America has done a very bad job maintaining its infrastructure for dispersing benefits to jobless Americans. And as a result, we actually have a better system of getting this money to people. Even if people stay at home, they can technically be on payroll and not have to go through, what I've talked to many, many, many people. It's just the absolute nightmare of applying for unemployment benefits and these completely overwhelmed state systems. On the other hand, you talk to, Bernie Sanders' office, people who support, Senator Sanders, and they say, look, you guys continue to scale back unemployment benefits in the final bill. The checks are really not as generous, and yet the PPP money continue to grow. This is a huge mistake. We could have sent bigger rounds of checks that would have gotten to people very quickly, and the business lobby is just too powerful, and that's the reason that money, continue to grow.
So of the $429 billion that was left over from the CARES Act that is being applied to this $900 billion portion of the aid, if the liability shield and state and local aid ends up being passed, how much of that is the $130 billion that you're talking about that was just sitting in that Treasury fund? And then how much of it, what comprises the rest of that money?
So this is another really good question. I feel like people are very confused about, so maybe I'll try probably ineffectually to bring clarity to Twitter and elsewhere. I think what's important to keep in mind is that the PPP money that was left over is separate from the, sorry, did I lose you for a second?
We got you.
What I was trying to say is the PPP money that's left over is separate from the exchange stabilization fund money that is the 429 you're referring to. Wow. The PPP money was really direct grants in funding left over. And that was, I don't remember the exact number, but $150 billion, something like that, that had been was still unappropriated. There's a separate pot of money. I know this gets so boring and people's eyes glaze over, but the second pot of money was provided. This was a lot of the talk of the sort of the corporate slush fund, bailout fund for Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. That was capital that was supposed to be used to then give out loans for liquidity markets, for ailing governments, for ailing businesses. That money, most of that funding was not really used at all. But it's a totally different pot of business aid than the PPP. And it's also worth keeping in mind that this money, it's a little complicated, but it's not just like traditional cash sitting around. It's really capital reserves that were intended never to really be spent, but to form sort of the principle that on which Treasury and the Fed would then make loans in excess of trillions of dollars. But it's not the same thing as just having like $100 billion in PPP money sitting around and waiting to be spent. In fact, CBO is still likely to count that money being reappropriated here as new spending, even though Republicans wanted to be able to tell their base and their caucus, like, hey, this isn't really new money because it's just sitting around. I mean, that's kind of true, but they have a clear incentive to make the bill looks, the Republican leadership that wanted to do something, they won't need to tell their right flank, hey, this bill is not as big as the Democrats are making it seem to be. And so they're sort of downplaying, that as new spending, even though I think, most of the economists and likely like the actual budget nerds will like count it as new spending.
Yeah. Now I should just say, sadly, we're not one of those places that get bored with this conversation about that Fed Capital Reserve. Now, and just to be clear, this is one of the things that people were complaining about, at least on the left, with the CARES Act, was this $500 billion, which was used as essentially, a backstop to trillions of dollars worth of loans that were going out to corporations, more or less free money for corporations alone. But again, if you give me $1 billion for free and say I don't have to pay you back in for a year, I'm going to be very happy with that, because I can go out and I can find 2 or 3%.
The average American does not have access to a 0% loan from the federal government right away.
Exactly. And now, ostensibly, this was also supposed to backstop municipal and state loans as well, or bonds. How much of that still remains? Because at one point, Mnuchin was talking about pulling that back. And I know that was a late attempt by some Republicans to pull that money back, particularly to provide it for bonds for state and local municipal entities. My understanding is that was underused, but I imagine going forward we may see more use out of that as things get more dire.
I think, and again, I'm not a Fed reporter, but my strong understanding is that, you know, under Janet Yellen, the Biden administration and, you know, Jerome Powell working with the Biden administration could get much more aggressive about, low interest loans to state and local governments that could help them out. And the fact that, you know, the money you were talking about was returned does not mean that Treasury and the Fed are out of capital to extend these kinds of loans. There's still very much money in those accounts that they can use. And that's why the late push from Senator Pat Toomey to rein in, exactly what they could do in terms of these municipal lending facilities proved such a sticking point. As we mentioned, state and local aid fell out of the bill, right? So all these states and cities that have laid off, I think the number is over a million public sector workers over the last, since the pandemic began, they're looking at this bill and saying, this is a huge problem. And I think, you know, I was talking to a Democrat recently who was making the point, like, look, we have all this PPP money, and that's going to keep all these people in the private sector employed. But if you're a public sector employee, there really isn't as much in this bill for you if you work for a state or city. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Biden team to say, how can we get creative with these federal, you know, what the money that's still left in the Federal Reserve account, in the Treasury accounts, and that could be lent through the Federal Reserve. The flip side that people are going to make and the pressure they're going to get from the other end of this is, you know, if you give a low interest federal loan to a small business or a state or city that misuses it, that misspends the money, that maybe mismanaged their funding before, that's going to become, you know, whatever Solyndra, you know, that Democrats get nervous about. Because when the government gives out money, like, it can be wasted or misused. You sometimes see this in the press about, you know, stimulus checks that were misspent or whatever. That I sometimes wonder about that reporting and that criticism, because, you know, nobody says, hey, you know, Grandpa used Social Security on 75 lotto tickets this month. Like, that is not something we typically criticize Social Security recipients for. But anyway, a long-winded answer, but it'll be definitely interesting to watch what they do with the money and how they could help state and local governments on their own.
All right, I want to put a fine point on this, because the idea that we've lost a million jobs in state in government workers, and I don't even know that we're even close to what it could be 6 months from now. Will you just put into context the implications of that? Because my understanding is, and it's been a while since I looked at these charts, but if you go back and look at the recoveries from the Reagan, Clinton, and Bush II recessions, that the way that we got out of that recession was to actually increase spending on government employees and basically across the board. I'm talking municipal, state, and federal. And when we didn't do that under the Obama administration, we all know that we had an incredibly anemic recovery that took almost a decade, really, to come back. Put that in context for us, how important the state and municipal funding is.
It's a great question. I think the optimistic reading of this is that this is not a traditional business cycle shock in which, you know what we saw in the Great Recession or the Great Depression or traditional recessions where, investors get skittish and you see a sort of slow-moving decline in savings, consumption, spending. This is actually a recession in which we've seen a massive increase in savings. Americans' saving rates is at an all-time high, I think in American history still at this point. And the optimistic reading is that when the vaccine arrives, this is, I think, the optimistic reading for the bill overall, that what we're really looking for is just trying to get us through the next few months. And that once the vaccine is widely distributed, people who have been saving, who put away some of their stimulus check money, who haven't been commuting to work, the savings rate is really high right now. Obviously, tremendous, tremendous, tremendous suffering, tens of millions of people in dire straits. But for many, many middle and upper middle class Americans, they are putting more money away. And that's, one of the reasons we've seen such widening inequality. But if the vaccine arrives and that money pours back into the economy, then the fact that state and local governments are hemorrhaging some money is not going to be, it's not the traditional story that you're alluding to, which is important to keep in mind for sure. The other component of this is that, I think I talked to a lot of mayors last week who were really, really upset about just feeling betrayed by the Democrats over this. And I understand, why they say that. The thing that they'll also say is that this bill is still a lot better for them than nothing passing. And if their constituents have another stimulus check, if their transportation agencies have more money, there's over $50 billion, I think it was, in the final bill for transportation authorities. The WMATA, the MTA in New York City, New Orleans is going to get some help. I mean, there is targeted help here for renters. And certainly compared to nothing, the states and cities are going to be better off under this bill than they otherwise would be financially.
Yes, compared to nothing. Compared to, yeah, exactly. That's true. And a vaccine coming in 2 years would be better than a vaccine never coming at all. But we're going to have, when that we all get vaccinated is going to have direct implications as to how many people live or die. And so something is sometimes better than nothing. Although sometimes that lets the air out of the tire and you don't get as much later. That may be operative as well. Jeff Stein, Washington Post, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so
much.
Hey,
pleasure being on. Happy to be on whenever you guys need me. Thanks so much.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth Pancotti. She is the policy advisor for Employ America. Okay, I'd like to welcome to the program Elizabeth Pancotti. She is policy advisor for Employ America. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you obviously focus on workers. Let's go through some of the top line numbers, and then we'll get into some of the sort of more narrow questions of the bill. We have two different types of unemployment essentially in this, right? We have sort of like a temporal extension and a financial augmentation.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there's an extension of some of the federal programs that give workers an additional 11 weeks of benefits on top of either their state benefits or their other federal benefits. And then just like we had from April through July, there's a top off to those benefits. So they'll get an extra $300 added to their checks for those 11 weeks.
So give us a sense of what happens if my unemployment runs out on the 26th, right? We have millions of Americans whose unemployment benefits run out. Are all those people extended? Give us a sense of how that works.
Yeah. So the pipeline here is a little messy, and a lot of it will depend on regulations. But what we know so far is that there are currently four types of programs you could be on. The first is that you're on state unemployment benefits, and that means you came on likely within the last 26 weeks, and you will stay on your state unemployment benefits until you exhaust, and then you will move on to a new program. So those people, they should be fine. They don't have to worry about anything. In a couple of weeks, they'll start to see $300 checks added on. We imagine that they won't be, so they should, they get started, they start to add on as of next week, but they probably won't see them on their checks next week, so they'll get a lump sum payment for that back pay. Okay. The second program they could be on is the PEUC program. That was extended by this bill, was set to expire Saturday, and that gives you 13, now 24 weeks after your state benefits. That program, if people were on it, right, if they're on it right now, they will be extended on it. However, a lot of states, because of the timing of this bill, they had already set that to expire, and they would have moved workers on to another program called the Extended Benefits Program if they're like if their state is triggered on. So not all states have EB right now. And so for those people, it's possible they'll have a temporary lapse in payments or that they'll be temporarily moved on to another program just in this like interim period while we set up the policies of this new bill. The third program is the EB program, and 24 states are currently triggered on to that program. And that gives workers between 6 and 20 weeks of additional benefits after their state benefits and PEUC. The problem, however, is in this bill, if workers were on state and then they exhausted PEUC, those 13 initial weeks from CARES, and then they went on to the extended benefits program, they have to clear out all of their extended benefits weeks before they can go to these new 11 weeks. Now, the big problem with that is that if you get 20 weeks of extended benefits and you use those 20 weeks over the next 11 weeks, you're not actually going to be able to claim the new PEUC weeks. And so what would have been better is to allow workers to go back onto PEUC. It's kind of a use it or lose it situation for like your PTO at work, right? If you don't use it in the time that you have to use it, you don't get those weeks. And so it's the same situation. The last potential program you could be on is called PUA. And that's that program built for kind of independent contractors, gig workers, or people who aren't eligible for UI traditionally. And so that program was extended also by 11 weeks. And those people additionally might face this kind of lapse in payments where over the weekend, many programs were set up to kind of expire because that was what the bill text said. And we passed a bill at the very last minute. And so it's likely that those people will lose benefits for a few weeks and then be brought back on and get back pay for those weeks. So that's kind of where we stand for the four different types.
Elizabeth.
Sorry.
I imagine you you study other countries' unemployment systems. How I mean, I'm just sitting here, like, listening to you explain this, and thank you for being able to walk us through this. But it sounds insane the way that we set up. I mean, like, honestly, like, if I was going to sit into a laboratory, try and figure out what can I make the most complicated Byzantine system and make it like, and really make people pay essentially for the benefits, the unemployment benefits that they're getting, like really make them, you know, just make it as painful as possible. This is what I would do.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds insane to me.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the big problem is partially that there are 53 separate systems of unemployment insurance. Because you've got all state systems, you know, DC, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. And so there are all of these different state systems that have different rules, different regulations, different enforcement of all these things, different benefit amounts, different eligibility. And on top of that, you have these new federal requirements and new federal programs that get implemented at the very last minute where we don't have time to implement them because we've defunded state UI offices. Like, it's truly a terribly designed system and an intentionally terribly designed system. Like, you know, if we look at other welfare programs, it's incredibly hard in the United States to access these programs. Like, none of these kind of barriers are accidental. And even in this bill, we see that. So now a new thing was introduced in this bill for program integrity. And that is that PUA, recipients of pandemic unemployment assistance, those like gig workers and people that aren't eligible for state UI, they will now be required to provide documentation for why they're eligible for PUA. And previously they could attest under the threat of perjury that they were eligible for X reasons, and then they would receive a bit of a benefit. And then if they provided income documentation, they could get a bit more, you know, they could contest for more money. And now they will be required to provide some sort of documentation for a COVID diagnosis, for their kids' school closures, for needing to isolate because they have asthma or pre-existing condition, all of these different things. So far, we haven't seen, we'll need guidance from the Department of Labor to know exactly what they'll need to submit for those. But I mean, this language like came from you know, conservative offices that in the name of program integrity wanted to kind of create barriers for these workers. And as you said, like if we went into a laboratory and said, what are all the bad things we can do? We have done a lot of them.
Emma's mic is not. All right, Sam, you're muted.
Don't know how that happened. Go ahead, Emma. Sorry.
Yeah. And additionally, I remember reading some things at the beginning of the pandemic about how state unemployment offices, some of them were still in the red or were had very little money to provide for people. So that's why the federal assistance was so needed. But you have state unemployment offices who are lacking funding, lacking money, and then also red state unemployment offices where they've basically been gutted entirely. So can you talk about the extra complications when it comes to some of those red states and some of those unemployment offices that are in dire straits financially and were so even before the pandemic began?
Yeah. So, I mean, the last few states that had loans for their, so basically what happens is employers pay taxes on their employees' wages into the UI system, and then they're distributed through the UI system. And so in times of great unemployment, there are, the federal government issues loans to states so that they can pay out these benefits. And in the Great Recession, I think like 29 states had taken out loans to pay out these benefits. And up until a year ago, there were still a couple of states still paying off those loans, and many were not meeting federal requirements for solvency or the kind of minimum balances required in those funds. This is also coming, you know, between 2010 and 2019, many states scaled back the benefits that they provide. They scaled back the eligibility for these programs. I mean, they truly do make it very hard. They make it an inaccessible program and a kind of, you know, not as beneficial program as it could be. The average UI benefit amount is about $375, and it replaces 30 to 40% of folks' income. And so, you know, these are all intentional design programs. In the OECD countries, we have the lowest income replacement rate. And in fact, we replace 0% of income after 6 months because states only offer up to 26 weeks in most cases. And so, you know, I think in terms of financing right now, there are about $45 billion in outstanding trust fund loans that have been taken out since March by 22 states and DC. You know, there's no way these states are going to be able to pay back these loans, and there are penalties for failing to pay back. They're not interest-free loans. And so, you know, we're charging states even more money when I think you guys were just talking about to Jeff about how in the hole state budgets are. These also, you know, these loans count against balanced budget laws in some states. You know, and I think we'll see what happened in the aftermath of the Great Recession, where states turned to austerity and they cut social services and they cut jobs because they don't have any money to spend. And it only benefit, you know, it doesn't benefit anyone. Like, it only harms workers and their families, especially with so many people.
I mean, that's part of the issue regarding the lack of funding for states and municipalities now, is that you can say once the vaccine comes, we're going to have an explosion of economic activity and revenues are going to be back. But that's a real problem going forward because they're getting in the hole with these interest bearing loans.
Yeah. I mean, these loans are not easy to pay back for many states in the Great Recession. They took 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years to pay back. In this bill, there was no discussion of forgiving those loans or providing any kind of additional federal funding benefits. This pop-off is thankfully going to help a lot of workers, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't replace income after it ends. And it, you know, there's no, it's an 11-week extension, right? There was no kind of fight for this to be in place until the unemployment rate goes down or until there aren't 20 million people claiming unemployment.
I think we're getting a little bit of static from your computer fan, I think.
You're sitting on a stack of books.
Oh, I understand.
I just hit mute and then unmuted, and it seemed to have helped.
Yeah, that helped a little bit. Let me ask you about this, because I mean, it's stunning that we have such a low replacement figure for employment payments. But it's even more stunning when you contemplate the idea that we want to encourage people to stay at home during a pandemic. And one of the things that was pulled out of the bill was that employers will no longer have to provide paid sick leave to workers who get infected with COVID-19. Will you talk about this? Because this is just another thing that just sounds insane to me. I mean, first off, we should have mandatory paid sick leave just in general. But during a highly contagious epidemic, I would imagine this is like the first thing that you would want.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is the first thing we'd want. There was a big fight that this was not, I mean, this was not included. In any summaries we saw of the previous kind of Manchin-Romney proposal, it wasn't included. Now it's included as a tax extender. And so businesses, if they offer paid leave, will be credited for that via taxes the same way that it was in CARES, except in CARES and in the second bill, Families First. You had to offer this program. And now it's, you know, if you want to offer it, we'll pay for it. I would imagine many businesses can't afford to go without workers when half of their workforce is out with COVID. And, you know, that's not a great thing. And so, you know, I think, yeah, you're right to say that in the 21st century, we should just have paid leave. There are 5 states that have it. And in the rest of them, you know, workers are left without any benefits in many cases. In addition, you know, we don't have universal health care. And so folks are right now foregoing medical treatment, you know, including COVID treatment, because they can't afford to get it. And when you have 20 million people out of jobs and when your insurance is tied to your employment, it's very likely that, you know, I know when we get the figures for insurance rates this year, it's going to be really bad. And I don't know how you would afford, you know, if you're not eligible for Medicaid, I don't know how you would afford like an Obamacare program or a private insurance exchange program where you could be covered by insurance after you lost your job on unemployment that's, you know, $300 a week. So I think it's like a two-part issue. Like this is, one, a public health crisis, and two, an economic crisis, and they're very intertwined. And somehow every policy we have and every policy response we have just comes up short in failing to, provide for both of those issues.
And we should say, even in the best case scenario, and I'm saying that half facetiously, you lose your job, you're not eligible. It's not like you can go immediately on Medicaid, right? Like, because the numbers that they're looking at are backward looking numbers, not forward looking numbers. So if I'm out of work and I'm out of unemployment, and I'm looking forward and I have no income coming in, I'm still not eligible for Medicaid until that period of time is in my rearview mirror. And so we're going to have these huge gaps where people are not getting covered. So what else? Is there anything else in the bill or anything else that is absent from the bill that you think is absolutely crucial to know about? And maybe one that in the event, I mean, there's talk that Biden is going to go for a second bite at this apple later. I don't know under what will have to happen to Mitch McConnell for that to happen. But let's just assume maybe there's a chance that the Democrats win in Georgia. What sticks out as you look at this advocating for workers? What sticks out for you in this bill?
Okay, so I'll say 3 things that I think we have to fix and then 1 thing that's really good. I'll start with the good news. So the SNAP and the nutrition assistance benefits in this bill, actually there's 2. So SNAP and nutrition benefits in this bill are amazing. There's a huge increase, especially for households with children. And given that, you know, school closures are happening again, we're heading into the holidays where kids aren't going to school. That's going to be a really big help to households with children when we know, you know, 1 in 5 households with kids can't put enough food on the table. And so that, I think, you know, the SNAP provisions of this bill really will help workers and their families, especially, you know, those on unemployment insurance.
One caveat to that.
Yes.
My understanding is that there's a ton of money sitting at the USDA that has not been delivered to folks, to those kids in particular, who have not been getting their lunches in schools, yes, that they have not gotten the funds. So the funds have been allocated, but because of the nature of the administration we have now, that really does not have very much interest in government functioning, the money's not reaching the people it's supposed to.
That's true. We do have a new U.S. Department of Agriculture secretary on his way. And so I would hope that that's, you know, a day one priority. You know, I think there are going to be legislative priorities for the Biden administration and administrative priorities that should be, you know, on the top of the list for administrative. The second good thing in the bill is that it includes $25 billion for rental assistance. We know that 1 in 6 renters are behind in rent by thousands of dollars. And so, you know, working with local housing agencies, states and the federal government are really going to inject money into that. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, the eviction moratorium is only extended to January 31st. I don't know how you would back pay $5,000 in rent by the end of January when you're making $200 a week in UI. And so that, I think, is another bright spot of the bill. I guess the one is, too, is that we didn't include liability shields for corporations. And that's a huge thing. You know, McConnell had been very insistent. Republicans had been very insistent about stripping even the like small fines that OSHA is able to give out for the past several months, and to pass a huge stimulus package, even if not as big as we need or not as big as we would have liked. That not being in the bill, I think, is monumental. The three things I think we need to fix are, there are a couple technical provisions in the UI part that I think had we not been negotiating with, McConnell and people like Chuck Grassley and whatnot, like those wouldn't have made it into the bill. And so if there was room to make those technical, those technical adjustments, I think that'd be a big thing. Senator Wyden had a really, really great UI bill come out, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago that would have included all of those technical fixes and would have really expanded access and integrity in the program, and I think for workers. And so I think, if we could just take the Wyden text and make it into a bill, that'd be great. Senator Warner also fought really hard for those provisions and they didn't make it into the bill. And so I think more work there is needed. The second thing is that we extended these programs for 11 weeks. We extended an eviction moratorium for 1 month. Like, none of these timelines are sufficient, nor do they really even get us through like the installment of the new administration, given that we're going to spend all of January and February on hearings. And so I think Employee America has been shouting about this and all the nerds have been shouting about this. But if we stop tying arbitrary end dates to these policies and said they will be in place until the unemployment rate falls or until workers no longer need them or until renters no longer need them or until state and local governments no longer need them, that I think is a big thing that, we should just say until the unemployment rate is back where it was before February, provide enhanced unemployment insurance. The last thing is the language around the Federal Reserve lending facilities that I think you and Jeff touched on before I was on. And, Senator Toomey fought really hard to end these lending facilities. He did say in a statement, and so did Secretary Mnuchin, they said that, Janet Yellen and Chairman Powell could come back to Congress and say, we need these facilities and we need backstops for them. And, you need to provide funding and authority for us to lend to state and local governments and, to corporations that employ people. Unfortunately, those programs, those lending facilities were designed in such a way that many, municipalities and state and local governments and, all sorts of people couldn't use them effectively. And as a result, we're either going into, either cutting spending or going into kind of private market debt where a Federal Reserve lending facility could have helped them. And we could have kept workers on payroll. We could have kept state and local governments in check. And so those, were designed with Secretary Mnuchin to really exclude the kind of power that they could have had. Unfortunately, the language in this bill really does limit the 13(3) lending facility powers of the Fed, especially for emergency facilities. And so I think revisiting that and trying to, inject what we can into creating effective lending facilities at the Federal Reserve would probably be a good place to start too.
All right, good. Just quickly, I just want to go over those last two. The automatic stabilizers you were talking about, which is basically saying instead of an arbitrary cutoff, 8 weeks, 11 weeks or whatever, we benchmark it against the success of the economy, essentially, yeah, as measured by how many people are working, how many people are, need food assistance, whatever it is, in terms of we benchmark it based upon the needs of the American public. This is something that was people were highly critical of the Democrats for not pushing more in the original CARES Act, because that was the last time that there was a lot of leverage. And the second point, and you need a legislative fix for that, we should say. Right? Like that's not something that the administration can extend unilaterally through existing statutory authority. Although I would imagine there's some play in some of that, but I don't know.
I think when end dates are codified into legislation, you don't have a lot of room in regs to change them.
Okay, fair enough. And then in terms of the lending facilities, do you need a legislative fix for that? Or is there authority that the Fed has so they could unilaterally extend some of these lending facilities for states and cities?
So I think that will come down to the interpretation of the phrase "the same." So it was, in the text, there was a lot of arguments of whether or not the lending could we stand up facilities that were similar to the ones stood up in by the CARES Act or prior to by the Federal Reserve and kind of backstop by that $450 or so billion dollars? Or do we need legislation for the Fed to lend to these types of programs? Honestly, there, I think it's going to be a lot of lawyers duking out what needs to be done administratively and what needs to be done through, legislation. There, I think it's really just going to be a fight among a bunch of lawyers. I will say that 13(3) does provide for even more, the Federal Reserve Act section for this does provide even more. I would argue, and my colleagues at Employee America would argue that, they had a lot more wiggle room than they had taken advantage of. And Chair Powell could have been more aggressive on these facilities, even in absence of legislation. I think, there may be caution to do that, given how politicized this was. And I think, Fed independence is so important that people are really hesitant to kind of step on the toes of that or to kind of sound any alarms on that. And I would hope that, you know, there we would push the bounds as far as we can so that the Fed can step in to save the economy. There, I think, though, you know, senators didn't like when the Fed started doing things when they weren't doing anything. And so I think it, you know, people ignore the Fed a lot of times, and that is maybe the wrong decision. I think Chair Powell did a lot of good to say this is how far we can push things when Congress isn't acting. And I would assume and hope that he will continue to do that in coordination with Secretary Yellen when she comes into office.
Elizabeth Pancotti, Policy Advisor, Employ America. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. All right, folks. There you have it. The good, bad, and ugly of this this relief package. And so much is riding, Emma, on Georgia. If Ossoff and Warnock, and it is very, very difficult, you know, I've read it. It always feels like you can read positive sort of tea leaves about early voting and whatnot. But it feels like 50-50 to me in terms of whether these are an indication. But if the Democrats control the Senate, it's going to mean a lifeline. I mean, you know, and it won't be sufficient, I think, for what you and I would want. But it's going to mean a lifeline, just barely, yeah. But a lifeline nevertheless for millions of people, because this bill is clearly insufficient. And it's hard for me to imagine that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are going to want to do anything for the American public if they can stop it.
Right. Well, Biden has said that he wants to do another relief bill, however I would imagine smaller than this, particularly likely when unemployment benefits expire in mid-March. That's not going to happen if Democrats don't take back these two Senate seats. Just not going to. McConnell won't allow it. So the stakes couldn't be higher, as you mentioned.
And that's something obviously we're going to be watching when we come back from vacation. And throughout that time, folks, thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow for our final live program.
Wow.
Of 2020. I cannot tell you how happy I am to put this year in our rearview mirror, but we'll have more to say about that tomorrow. And don't forget, you can catch us at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. on the Peacock app, the Choice channel. You can also just search Cedar or Majority Report in that app, and you can find us anytime. We'll see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are sticking around, we will head into the fun half of the program. Nomi Const, I think, should be joining us any moment.
Wow, it's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday already.
I completely am. I'm just lost track of.
Yes, I am indefinitely that sort of like pre-vacation mode where it's running out the door. Nomi, you there? We see your picture. Folks, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. We're going to be doing it for part of break anyways. Check it out, amquickie.com. Get 6-7 minutes of headline news every morning via podcast. Don't forget shop.majorityreportradio.com for merch. Nomi, who's on your show today?
Great question. I'm pulling up my booking sheet right now. Oh, man, I should know these things. I feel like the last few days have been insane. What I will do while I'm doing that, because I should know this off the top of my head, is I will announce something that's very exciting. Can I do that instead?
Sure. Yeah.
This is... I feel very honored. I didn't even ask for that. Okay, so... a few of our viewers and listeners were messaging me like, what books are you reading? What books are you reading? And I'm sure they do that with you guys as well. And I decided, a few years ago, I did this challenge where I read one book a week for an entire year, and it was very difficult. So I thought, why don't we start a book club? And so the Nomi Key Show now has a book club, and thank you to everybody who's already signed up. I'm actually really surprised. I didn't think it was going to be so quick. But everybody, you can go to the Nomi Key Show Patreon, patreon.com/the Nomi Key Show. There's three levels, one book a month, 2 books a month or 4 books a month, because I need a community to hold me accountable. And they're not all like 700 page books. Like the Tammany, or the Plunkett of Tammany Hall is this small. So, you know, if you're part of the, well, we try to balance it out, and we do, we'll have discussions every week on each of the books, depending on what level you're in, and with the authors, with people reading it along with us. But the first book is actually a gift for early people who sign up right away. Professor Harvey Kaye decided that he was going to donate a bunch of his books on Thomas Paine. So that's our first book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's a classic. And that's what we're starting with.
Oh, hell yeah.
Great idea. You know, Matt, maybe you should get in on that. Matt.
Yes.
Matt came and applied for the show. I don't know if you heard this story, Emma. Matt came in for his interview. I don't know how it came up. I don't know if you actually just started, you led with that, Matt, but
it's the top of my resume, probably.
Matt had read, I think it was 153 books in the year before he came in.
What?
What?
It was the unemployed year after I graduated from NYU, so I had time. That's
read or listened to? Let's clarify.
Both. Right. Yeah, that was my deep reading.
Tell them your technology for reading books, consuming books.
So yeah, in college, basically my thesis was on using both audio and text at the same time to sort of add that redundancy for recall purposes. So I basically would speed read audiobooks at, like, you know, 3 times the narration speed, and then have the text in front of me. The key is to, like, start slower, and then once you get familiar with, like, the nouns and, you know, the general ideas of the text, you can a third of the book you can fly through. But anyway,
not drug addict, but for books,
I mean, yeah, there's a little bit to that.
Perfect.
Yeah. Wait, we're gonna have to have you on, because I don't think I can do a book a week, depending on some of the sizes and the weeks. So I would love to get your tips. Maybe we can have you on, like, the first show to advise us.
It's a lot harder when you have a job, I found, to do that.
Yeah, why don't you layer in kids on that and then see how you do, buddy? You can watch a movie at 3 times speed.
Or Twitter, guys. Come on, let's just be real. Like, that's where we spend most of our time.
Unfortunately,
Also, folks, check out The Antifada. They've got a new Twitch stream, twitch.tv/TheAntifada. Matt, what's happening in the Matlek world media empire?
Yeah, for Left Reckoning patrons, and then for everybody on Wednesday, David Griscom has an interview with Ashok Kumar, or Brosif underscore Stalin on Twitter, about India's historic farmer protests and general strike, and what's next. So if you've been curious about that, if you're a patron, you can get it right now on audio and video. And we're going to put it on the show on Wednesday night. We're going to move up the show because of the holiday. So there'll be a live stream Wednesday night for Left Reckoning.
All right. Quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be back in a second.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.